Good morning to you. Anyway, I'm very aware, and this is something I'm British, kind of, fourth generation Italian, actually, Bellini, so I should be speaking in the mother tongue of my homeland, but time passes, and we've got to find some language or other to speak in, and English is the one I currently use. So my apologies for that. I just thought I'd remind you, though, that something I've had a lot of experience in, which is presentation training and presentation skills, which I will not touch on today unless you want me to. And one of the reasons is we haven't got time. But also, secondly, there is a separate session. I just thought I'd point it out. Probably most of you have noticed at 3 o'clock today, dealing with speaking and presentation skills for meeting professionals, Alan Stevens. So I just thought I'd flag that up, because that is equally important, I think. Now, I don't know how many of you are thinking, why? Have you spotted it? Have you found it? I suggest you, if you're interested in the whole notion of giving a presentation, constructing a presentation, delivering it, then you might want to go to that particular session. I don't want to make this a formal kind of lesson, like a schoolroom, so I try to make it as two-way as possible. If you want to stick a hand up, or you want to contribute, or whatever. But anyone want to set off our thinking processes by telling me what they think this subject is all about this morning, and why it say it's different from presentation skills? Is it the word leadership that's caught your eye, or is it the word communication?
Leadership.
All right. Both. Why, leaders have to communicate in a different way? They probably do.
They have to be able to vocalize the vision, the mission of the company, unite people behind them.
Yeah.
Through communication.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, thank our sponsors, the Berlin Convention Office, who've sponsored this particular session, and we'll press on. Now, my start point, actually, in looking at all of this, and you might think, you know, who is this guy? On Sunday, he gave a talk about the future. And now he's talking about communication and leadership and things like that. I've had sort of two careers that have run in parallel, actually, and I have two different sort of suits of armour, suits of clothing. I'm a writer, and I just want to share with you some of the books I've written. This one was about corporate crisis. It was about stories like Bhopal in India. Do you remember when an enormous chemical plant went up and killed many, many people living around it, and how that particular company was damaged, but not very much. So I became very interested in the whole area of corporate reputation, and I spent a lot of my professional career, apart from thinking about the future, helping leaders, you know, senior people in organizations, companies, government departments, to deal with crisis. And I think that's part of being a good leader, how to deal with a crisis verbally. Because leadership communication generally, is not only about what you say, it's what you do. It's also about what you do not say and do not do. So that's an important thing. So that's one book which brought me into the whole area of how industry and business generally is really quite a dangerous quite a dangerous inhabitant of this planet, so they create crises. It's an old book, it's about 15 years old. I don't suggest you read it, unless you know, you're a glutton for punishment. But my most recent book is called The Bullshit Factor, and that's quite a new book. I became very interested in the whole issue of corporate dishonesty after... You can get this secondhand on Amazon, by the way. In fact, if you go to my website, you can download the first section for free. I don't believe in necessarily selling loads of books. I am the publisher, by the way, and so I live in a world of words and pictures anyway. But go to my website, jamesmeaney.com, and you can download the introductory section, which is more or less all you need to know. But the concept of bullshit is the difference between what you do and say and what you actually mean. Okay? It's a very honest term. One of the reasons I published it and set up a publishing company is that no other publisher would touch it. They didn't like the name, the title. Bullshit, we can't publish books called bullshit. And I said, but there's a very famous essay by a moral philosopher called Harry Frankfurter. Have you heard from him about Harry Frankfurter? He's professor of moral philosophy at Princeton. And he wrote a wonderful essay called On Bullshit. And bullshit, as I say, is the difference between... Well, he was interested in the difference between truth or lying and bullshit. And basically, the difference, he said, between a liar and a bullshit artist... Sorry about the words, but I mean, are you all comfortable with the vocabulary? Okay. Is that someone who is a liar knows the difference between truth and fiction. A liar knows the difference between truth and fiction. And therefore, they are able to tell the difference between truth and fiction. A bullshit artist, you know, it's the guy who comes up to the pretty girl in a bar and tells her that he's a millionaire, or he rides a Harley Davidson, or something like that. Young fellow at the back here rides a Harley Davidson. Own up, come on. Because I mention it in my talk on Sunday, you know, about affluent gerontocracy.
Huh? It's very rude, I told everybody.
Good. And because the difference between the two is that a bullshit artist has lost touch with truth. And therefore, bullshit is more dangerous than lies. And you might think, what on earth has this got to do with this kind of session? Well, the book, I started writing this book after Enron and after Arthur Andersen. Arthur Andersen, if you remember, the prime accountancy and auditing firm in the world, number one, the blue chip, the gold standard. And they were the ones that helped Enron cook the books. And they were the ones that shredded the papers so as Enron could continue on their illegal financial practices. And so I was really curious about why companies behave the way they do. And so I studied this subject with the help of a clinical psychologist, and we wrote the book in effect together, my words, many of her insights. She was a Hungarian psychologist. And together we unraveled the story of why corporations behave the way they do, and why leaders behave the way they do. Why, for example, the chief executive of ExxonMobil, the oil company, until 4 years ago, said there was no scientific proof for global warming. The bosses of the big tobacco companies, the so-called big tobacco, could stand up in Congress in Washington and on oath, on the Bible, if you like, could tell Congress that in their view there was no connection between smoking and cancer. And I got interested in why they could actually do all this. Now, what's changed now are the rules of the communication game. Does anyone remember this famous quotation from Henry Ford way back when he launched the Model T car? You can have any colour you like. Yeah, okay. And that's still remembered today. And the interesting thing about it, of course, is it's not true. He never did say that. And the reason he couldn't have said it is they never produced the Model T in black. It was produced in red, grey and green. But there's a lot of mythology about what leaders say, and it sticks forever. And I think the difference between Henry Ford 100 years ago, and it was literally 100 years ago, and today, is that 100 years ago, business was conducted in a totally non-transparent world. In fact, we've estimated that about 90% of corporate profits... Am I going too quickly? Is it okay? 90% of corporate profits in the 20th century in general, 90%, were generated by the fact that consumers could not easily compare between different offers. Most markets then were local or regional, rarely national, never international or global. But now in the global marketplace, and because of technologies, the great conversation, as we call it, the internet conversation, because of all of that, you cannot get away with telling lies anymore. And so the context for leadership communications has changed. And I think the third area is that the concept of leadership itself has changed. And I want to spend just a few moments at the end, if I can, looking at that. So these are the areas that I want to touch on. As I say, I don't want to make this a formal classroom, this one. Just stick a hand up if you want to say something or you're curious about something. But all the rules have changed. The rules for the environment within which you communicate have changed. Now, apart from writing books, I was lucky enough to spend 20, 25 years in television as a television anchorman for the BBC, and I think you heard that in the introduction on Sunday. But I learnt a lot about the use of words when I was doing that. I learnt, for example, at the BBC that you should only work to a vocabulary of 800 words. Rule number one about good communication is keep it simple. In fact, we have something called the KISS principle, K-I-S-S. It's either keep it simple, stupid, or keep it simple, etc., etc. And if you can work to a vocabulary of 800 words, as I was taught, trained to do at the BBC, you'll actually achieve the first point, which is simplicity and clarity. All right, so I'll share that with you as well. So quickly look at, what is leadership communication all about? Well, it's about a number of things, but the first thing it's about, and always will be about, is about protecting and enhancing the most important asset on your balance sheet, which is your reputation. And reputation is quite simple, really. Here's a case study. Do any of you remember this picture? It went round the world. Mercedes have a test called the elk test, or the moose test. An elk is a very large animal you find in Scandinavia and northern Canada. And this is a test, a manoeuvre of the vehicle, where it assumes that they have just run into a very large animal coming towards them. And what happened here is the car, of course, is supposed to stay on four wheels. And as you can see, it didn't. And that was a terrifying image of that particular product. And that did a huge amounts of damage to Mercedes. And all you needed was the picture. It doesn't say anything else. We'll call it the new Mercedes A car, shall we? When everyone said to someone, what do you think of the new Mercedes A car? Ooh, does that, doesn't it? Because they saw the picture. And a picture is worth 1,000 words, by the way. And that's why television is such a powerful medium. Such a powerful medium. And the picture is too. They had to withdraw the product. They spent millions and millions of extra Deutschmarks, I suppose, then, on modifications to improve it and change it. You got the late bus, didn't you? Ooh, is that in the laptop?
Yeah, if you don't plug it in, it's going
to... I thought it was plugged in. I tell you what, we've got these, what they call knowledge assistants. I'll go and get one. Never heard them called that before. Hello, we have a problem with the battery on there, it's running down. Okay. What we need is probably a direct power supply.
Okay,
do you mind? Thanks. You see, rule one, I'm going to give you a free seminar on presentation technique as well, because rule one, something I learnt in the TV business, is that don't ever rely on the technology. And that's why I carry hard copy of all of them. And people say, why do you carry hard copy? Don't you know what you've got in there? Yes, I do, but I also know that that happens. And the worst thing in TV studios is when, you know, what we call autocue or portaprompt or teleprompt, all the words are up there and you say, oh, I don't need a script, I can go in there and look brilliant. Actually, you look really stupid when that technology goes down, as it does from time to time. It's only a machine, after all. And so you can use this. So I happen to know rule one here. You see, I know that the next one is brand confidence collapses. And then, of course, all the rivals chip in. I mean, Volkswagen must be drinking a lot of champagne at the moment because they're in exactly the same market segment. As I say, subtext on presentation, never ever trust the technology and never make your technology too difficult or complicated either. I mean, this young fellow at the beginning asked me, how much video do you have to show? Don't try it, not for another 10 years. I don't think the technology is good enough. It will crash. And don't ever try and go online in the middle of a presentation. I've seen so many people come unstuck. You know, let's go onto our website and I'll show you all about it. No, not a good idea. Not a good idea. So, the most important asset on your balance sheet is your reputation. Anyone here want to define reputation? There's actually another concurrent talk this morning. Actually, I think it's 11 o'clock. Go and listen to it. It's Brand You, or Branding Yourself as a Personal Brand. And really, Jeff Bezos put his fingers on it. Jeff Bezos, founder of Amazon. He said, your brand is what people say about you when you're not in the room. And actually, it's the same as reputation. The reputation of any brand is what people say about it when you're not there. And if you just we remind ourselves how valuable, incredibly valuable, these brands are. This is not the value of the company. This is the value of what's left when you take the company away. This is what it would cost, in theory, to create a brand, say, as good as Coca-Cola. That's what it would cost you to generate that brand. And the problem with a brand is it's incredibly, incredibly vulnerable. It takes 15 to 20 years to build a reputation. You can destroy it in half an hour. Yeah.
Would you say Toyota's not the same level right now as it is on the church?
Which?
Toyota.
No. I only put this up as illustrative. If you Google brand values, you get dozens of charts like this. But I would think not. Why not? Do you think so?
No,
I mean, that's why I said champagne. A lot of champagne's been drunk at Volkswagen because they've been bang in the middle of the same types of model range as Toyota. Now, all you want from a car, surely, is that it starts and it stops and the accelerator and the brakes went. So this is strange because if you'd asked me a year ago, ask anyone in the room a year ago, which company in the world had the highest levels of reputation for manufacturing standards, you'd have said Toyota, because it wasn't, not only was it the top manufacturer of cars in the world, it was the top manufacturer, full stop, in all domains. And so, massive damage. Now, my view is, the reason the damage has been accentuated is because of their very, very poor response. Because there are case studies, which I'll share a couple of them with you, because I don't want to stick on reputation all the time, although it is important. And leadership communication, in the end, is about how you communicate to all your stakeholders. And your stakeholders include your employees, your shareholders, your local and neighborhoods and so on, and of course your customers. But the reaction of Toyota, in my view, was very slow. It was very limited and restricted. And my personal view again, and this is what I looked at in the Bullshit Factor book, by the way, is that there's a lot to do here with the Japanese corporate culture. Because it's very inward and it's very closed. And I think that got in the way of their communicating more effectively, more quickly, about the product problems they had. Because, you know, you can't cover it up. In the end, the numbers will come home to roost. That will come home to do you damage. The numbers will, and what you say will come home to do you damage. So whatever you do, you speak quickly. And the first things you say always travel the furthest. I think that's one of the key rules here. The first things you say travel the furthest. Whether you're talking to employees or to your wider marketplace. And Toyota was, I'm afraid, another case study that goes in the book alongside the good ones like Johnson & Johnson with the product tampering right through to Shell with the Brent Spar oil platform in the mid-90s. Brands need managing, another bit of science here. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but reputation in your brand, that's all you've got as an organisation. And it doesn't have to be a car manufacturer. All the organisations you work for have got a brand. All of them. And what I find, when I'm training people to go on the media and to deal more effectively with media interviews, the first question I ask them is, what is your product? And very few of them really think about it that way, or argue about it that way. You know, if you asked Apple what is their product, they'd say, well, we make computers, but actually what we do is help people achieve their best, and they see it more accurately that way. The most famous quote about products, true products, is Charles Revson, who founded the Revlon Corporation, cosmetics. He said, our factories make cosmetics, but what we sell is hope. Which I think is a bit sad, that I know. Think about that for a minute. Okay, there's lots and lots of science. There's lots and lots of science about brand reputation management, brand management, reputation protection, crisis management, and so on. It's actually all of them. All of them. It's everything you do, everything you say. When we did Bullshit Factor, we examined, I looked at every aspect of what a corporation does, even the colour of its logo. I mean, why is Virgin Airlines bright red, the corporate colour? Because Richard Branson is obsessed with sex. Bright red, passion, is also the colour of Ferrari, of Ducati. They're also passionate products, Italian passionate products. Would that be fair? Are you Italian? You understand. But Branson, in Branson's case, it is the bright red of passion, and as I say, here's a man who completely, completely obsessed with sex. There was a wonderful article recently in an Australian newspaper. They said, we've found a new micro-measurement. It goes in between the micron and the millimetre, and it's called a Branson. And a Branson, they said in the article, is the minute distance between Richard Branson and a topless model. Because every time he launches a product, he's always got dancing girls and so on. So you might think, this is just a joke. It's not. It's important. Because Virgin Airlines, Virgin as a brand, is, at the moment, is Richard Branson. And so brands come in different shapes and forms. And Branson himself could destroy it in a minute by saying or doing something which was not acceptable. And so, as I say, there's lots of different sciences around the map of reputation. But in the end, it's the only thing you've got that runs your business. So reputation is what we think about you. It's not necessarily, as I say, rational. It isn't. The Japanese Toyota is invincible a year ago. Well, that wasn't particularly rational. We didn't really think about it. The Germans are very efficient. They might be, but what scientific evidence do we have stand that up? And it is often, and I say this as a journalist, by the way, shaped by limited, distorted information. And it's a start point, though, for all your business. Without a reputation, you don't have a business. You don't have a business. And so I think the primary responsibility of any leader, any management leader, is to protect that vital asset. It's something you can, but, as I say, it's about all sorts of funny questions that you don't normally think about. The brand of Coca-Cola, you think, is sufficient simply because you like drinking it. Well, actually that's the end point. The start point is, what does that company stand for? What are its values? What are its purpose? And those can only survive and grow if they're actually enhanced and communicated effectively by, not just the leader, by the way. I mean, I have a simple view that in a good company, everyone's a leader. And indeed, the new leadership agenda is that leaders are chosen by their stakeholders. They're not appointed from the top. That's the new concept of leadership. So we're all leaders in some respects. The problem with all of this, of course, is who knows what TMI stands for? You bet. Too much information. What happened to the paperless office? What happened to all those things that are supposed to die? I'm a futurist, professionally, and I spend a lot of my leisure moments, believe it or not, and it sounds very sad, reading old futurology books. It's worth it. Go back to get Alvin Toffler's Future Shock from the 1970s, for example, or Michael Rosen's Future Facts, and see some of the things they saw in the 21st century, like nuclear-powered hearts, atomic toilets. They were right with some things, flat-screen televisions, invisible aircraft, like stealth bombers. Yes, they were true. They were right with some. But things like the paperless office, never. Do you use more or less paper than you did 10 years ago, any of you? More? I mean, there has been a survey of this, actually, and it pointed to something which wasn't particularly startling, which is that with the rise of emails, the use of paper increased by about 100% in a typical company, because we're still old-fashioned. All of us here are digital immigrants, aren't we? Any digital natives here? Digital natives, somebody born into the digital age. But this is how you tell the difference. We had this, this came up yesterday in another session. When you get an email, if you're tempted to print it out, you don't have to print, if you're tempted to print it out, just so that you can keep it more effectively, then you're a digital immigrant. A digital native wouldn't, they don't even use emails, actually, they think they're old-fashioned. They think they're just for old, old immigrant people like us. And immigrants, of course, have strong accents, and because we've had to adopt a new language and a new culture. So, too much information. It's probably even bigger than this, but in a typical day, without realizing it, you are exposed to thousands and thousands of messages. And you're thinking, what has this got to do with communication? Well, good communication has to fight its way through all of this. It has to break through the TMI. And it breaks through the TMI by being simple and clear and positive. Just to remind ourselves how complicated our lives have become. Why is it when you go into a pharmacy these days that you're confronted with 14 different brands of dental floss? Why? I mean, dental floss is dental floss, isn't it? But we are bombarded with brand promises and brand offers that we have to work through. And this is where the communication task becomes even more difficult. Why is it when you go into a large supermarket there are 28 brands of orange juice? I mean, orange juice is orange juice, is it not? We lead very complicated lives. So the point about brand equity is to give you that differentiation. And you are the ambassador, this leader person we're talking about, this communicator, is the ambassador for the brand. And therefore, to be that ambassador, you have to have speak in a certain way and communicate values in a certain way. So, as I said earlier, people don't buy products. they buy the reputation and brands behind the product. Yeah, the point you're making is, I'll just repeat it so you can all hear, that this is more important in a service company. Is it? You think? Okay. A company I know very, very well, and many of you, unless you're British, will not have heard of it, is called Inchcape. Now, Inchcape, I wrote their corporate history recently and got to know them very well. And I discovered what they do now is that one of the world's biggest retailers of cars. Their biggest brand is Toyota, who actually own 10% of the company, so they're hurting at the moment. But the point I wanted to make is that they have discovered, as retailers of cars, high-level cars, BMWs and Lexus and so on, is that when that customer walks into the showroom to look at a car, they have already decided to buy that BMW. They've already decided to buy that BMW. All the research tells us that most consumers now, when they come to buy a product, whether it's a financial services product or something like a new car, they've already researched it online. And so what they're looking for when they come in to make the purchase is something else. They're looking for a customer experience, which sounds complicated, but actually what they want to know is whether you're nice people or not, and whether they will want to buy a car from you because you'll be dealing with them for the next 2 to 3 years as the owner of that car. And so they're looking for something else. They've already made a choice about that particular brand of vehicle. So that's very important, that you are actually the ambassador. Now, Walter Landor put his finger on it. Products are made in the factory, brands are made in the mind. In that sense, Charles Revson wasn't wrong. You know, we make cosmetics, but what we sell is something else. He said hope, but it could be something else. So these brands are very, very important. And every time you open your mouth, you have got to give your customers a reason to choose you. It's a very crowded marketplace, much more so than in the years of Henry Ford. He could say you can have any colour you like as long as it's black or red or green or whatever it was at the time, because that was a producer-driven economy. You know, that's the big difference. That was a producer-driven economy, because the producer could say, look, if you're really lucky, I'll sell you this car. Now it's the other way around. You might call it a customer-driven economy, where the customer defines the brand, and with the rise of all these online media, social networks and so on, it's communities that create brands. They increasingly shape your products, not you. You simply produce them and look after them and sell them, but they actually own the product. They actually design them, if you like. So, I think Ralph Nader, the great social activist, consumer activist, put his finger on it. It doesn't matter how much money you throw at it, and it's going to be interesting to see what Toyota do in the months and years to come to recover their reputation, because it is very, very damaging. There's case study after case study. Do anyone here remember the case of Perrier? Obviously, Perrier was a mineral water, French mineral water, owned by the Perrier family. And what are you selling? The product is water, but what they're selling is purity. You know, water from the mountain springs, purity. And then they had a problem. In one of their Austrian plants, there was a leakage of benzene, which is a poison, benzene into certain product batches. And of course, if all you're selling is purity, then benzene in the Perrier water is a bit of a problem. Did they survive? No. You might think, oh, hang on, but Perrier, I drank some last week. They survived as a product, but not as a company. The share price collapsed. The company went into difficult. I don't know if it had a share price. It was family-owned. Then the company went into huge financial difficulties because people stopped buying Perrier, and in the end it was bought out by Nestle, the Swiss company. And so Perrier died as a family-owned entity because of that one episode. So you only get one chance. If that product is something called purity, then you have to remain pure. And it's different things to different people. I'm going to whiz through this because I want to get to the later stuff. I want to look at this, really, because this is the new marketplace for communication. And the best way to understand the internet, really, is to see it as a gigantic global conversation. And if you're not in that conversation as an organization, then you don't exist. 10 years ago, it wasn't important. 10 years ago, you controlled the channels of information. You used newspapers, you used TV, you used advertising, you used marketing. You've lost control. The business world, the organizations of this world have lost control of the channels of communication. They're now owned by the people, if you like. It's almost a sort of socialist revolution. But that's the major threat of new media, that they have changed all the rules. And what we have now is the possibility, the opportunities for companies and organizations to be able to talk to one person and to be very refined in how they can analyze what customers want, because you can. If you work, most of you probably use Amazon. Every time you log on to Amazon, they'll tell you which books they suggest you read, because they have got a profile of you by now as to what you like reading and like buying, because they can see your previous consumer tendencies. And that's a very small example of how the new media are working to create very complex and granular pictures of each individual consumer. So the opportunities are there and the challenges are huge. As I say, information overload is one of them, I think. The use of paper, just to finish that point off, paperless office, forget it. In the past 30, 40 years, the studies tell us that the use of paper has gone up by 600%. 600%, so it's quite the opposite. And a recent book called The Myth of the Paperless Office, I suggest you read if you have time, it's printed on paper, by the way, is actually a research piece on why paper is popular. And partly because you're all writing on paper now. You could have used a pad. Because you like paper, you can put it in your pocket, you can fold it up, you can give it to somebody. You prefer reading a book to Kindle. Anyone prefer Kindle to a book? Don't know yet, we'll see. We've been trying. Hewlett Packard came out with a kind of Kindle about 10, 12 years ago. It never worked. It worked, but never sold. Because paper has something called affordances, which is a complicated word. An affordance is what it makes possible. You can do things with paper that you can't do with an electronic medium or an electronic device. And so there's a dichotomy here. Paper will always be valuable and important, but it's battling against all these new channels to communicate. And that's what's changed the most, I think, and the ownership. You know, the most successful newspaper in Korea has no journalists. It's called Oh My News, I think. Has no journalists. All the people who write in it are citizen contributors. Anyone in this room, if you want to write an article, if they publish it, you get $20. And it doesn't have a staff in the traditional form of a newspaper or indeed a TV station. And that's the way in which we're going, the whole notion of the citizen correspondent. And they are changing all the rules as well about how you communicate and how you as a leader can position yourself as a great communicator or not. Because it was easier in the past. Just remind ourselves of all the technologies that have changed our lives. You're all familiar with the one on the right, are you not? Look how far we've come since the first ENIAC mainframe computer. 18,000 vacuum valves. It was the size of 3 city transit buses put together. And I was saying to people at a seminar we did yesterday that today, even a singing birthday card has more computer power than Apollo 11, which put men on the moon. And so we are seeing something completely different here, a second Gutenberg revolution, if you like, the invention of book printing. We're seeing that again a second time. Now, what's making the communications game totally different is this whole area here of connectivity and content. The future is about content, and the digital native desire is primarily to be entertained. And the best way to deliver content, whether you're selling a product or advertising an event or whatever, is to make it entertaining. All the research on our new generation of digital natives tells us that what they want is to be engaged in an entertaining and interesting way. If you can entertain them, they'll believe the message, they'll take the message. So that's changed as well. All the technology coming through, all of it really coming to this one conclusion, which is something that struck me very hard. We all think the internet, up there, loads of wires and connections, and you're stuck in the middle and you don't really know what it's about. We don't even know who owns the internet, do we? It's not Rupert Murdoch yet, or Berlusconi yet. But this judge in a federal court, I think he got it right. The internet can be regarded as a never-ending worldwide conversation. Now, the reason I'm pushing this, and I think he was right, and it was in a case between the American Civil Liberties Union and the Attorney General Reno. So it was a test case between the government and this major professional pressure group. And really what is over privacy and copyright. Who owns stuff that's sent around the internet? Who actually owns it? And I think the notion of a conversation is really quite important, because nobody controls a conversation. It is two ways rather than one way. See, traditionally, I came into TV when it was still one way. Good evening, here is the news. Nothing came back. Nothing came back. Whereas now it is a conversation that goes in all directions, and no one controls it. And it's totally transparent. And this has changed all the rules. Looking forward into your careers in the next 5, 10, 20 years maybe, people who communicate and as people with leadership responsibilities, you've got to compete now with a massive amount of background noise. Massive amount of background noise. And it's not always good either. Most of it was emails, but actually if you look at instant messaging, it's taken over now. In fact, digital natives regard emails as very, very old-fashioned, pre-industrial almost. And so this is how information is carried around within organisations and across organisations and between people. And so that's the background in which you have to communicate. Blogs is another, of course, part of it. The figure on the right, 210 million, is probably out of date now because I did this last Friday. It's probably about 212 million blogs. And they have a doubling capacity. They double every year or so. So this is a phenomenon that we didn't even have 10 years ago. At the turn of this century, didn't exist blogging. Anyone here have a blog? Have a blog? Yeah? Roaring. Soaring. Soaring, that's right. Ladies and gentlemen, from Soaring, it used to be Soaring PR, and you've dropped it. Tell us why, quickly, because it proves the point, doesn't it? You used to regard yourself, well, people regard you as a PR agency. In other words, fighting through the fog. That's the problem. It never was the case, even 10 years ago. It's much easier to communicate effectively. Now there's too much stuff there, there's too much apparatus, too many barriers, and too many digital interferences, if you like. So just to add to all of this, but you can probably have 10 slides like this, all impacting on our brains and our visuality and our perceptions of life. So it just goes on and on and on. Now, what does this do? It creates something which you can be regarded as the collective intelligence, the new collective intelligence, and this is an important part of understanding what the new communications environment's about. Because, as I say, it's two ways. But mankind, humankind, have been creating collective intelligence since the beginning. Many of you will be aware of the cave paintings of 32,000 years ago in Chauvet. We talked about these in a seminar yesterday. But that was, in effect, an attempt by that community 30,000 years ago to leave something for the future, to leave a contribution to our collective memory for the future. Paintings of animals rushing across empty plains in southern Europe and so on. This is our life, you know, we want to share it with you for posterity. We've always done it, we always will. And the thing about the digital age is it's creating a new kind of collective intelligence, which is more or less the wisdom of crowds rather than the wisdom of the individual expert. So it changes your target market as well, in the sense that why are we communicating as leaders? Well, we're communicating to defend and protect and enhance our reputation, to spread the messages about our brand and our brand promise, all of those things. But that in itself is becoming more and more complicated as well, because although 10, 15, 20 years ago there was one marketplace, now we have an audience of one in a very particular way, and increasing media fragmentation. I guess the biggest victims of the digital age in advertising terms have been the old traditional advertising media. I think internet advertising, is it true in the UK? You might know. Internet carried advertising is now bigger than television or similar old style advertising channels. I was in the advertising business for a while. We were discussing this yesterday. It was dead easy then, you know, you have a bit of newspaper and a bit of TV and a bit of film, a bit of radio, maybe some posters at the bus stop, and that was more or less it. Now it's completely different game. I think the most important thing to start remembering now is WOMA, you know, word of mouth marketing. But as an historian of the future, I often tell people, I think there's nothing really ever new about this, because word of mouth marketing is nothing more than what we used to do when we met on the street corner or on a Sunday morning at church. You know, we would compare a product. Have you tried this new soap powder? Did you know so-and-so's got a new house? That's how we communicated information. It's still happening in the same way. It's happening electronically. That's the difference. Happening electronically, which is immediate, which is global, and, of course, which is permanent. That's the good and bad side of the digital world, is that it's permanent. The British Library is now assembling dead websites and they're putting them into archive, because they will be the historical resources of the future. They'll be our way of going back into time and seeing how we lived today and yesterday through our online presence. So I think Malcolm Gladwell, in his book, The Tipping Point, the whole concept of tipping point is taken from the medical idea of the virus and of epidemics, is taken from the science of epidemics. You know, where in an epidemic like swine flu or something like that, or SARS, you get an isolated infection, then maybe you get another one, then another one, and it grows to a point where it tips over into something which we then call an epidemic or a pandemic. So it's borrowed from that part of medical science. So it is a virus, and good and bad news has a habit of spreading through in a viral way. We call it viral marketing. I mean, you're probably obviously up on that. Is anyone not here involved in what you call viral marketing? You know, it works in many different ways, partly through psychology. There's one manufacturer of high-priced cameras, and they have whole teams of people who are given these cameras, and then they'll go out and circulate around famous landmarks, like the Statue of Liberty, say, or the Eiffel Tower. And they'll start taking photographs of each other. And if it's a swanky new camera, then it'll be interesting, and people will come up and start asking me, oh yeah, it's great, I've had this for a couple of weeks, it's fantastic, try this, have a look. They're salesmen, but nobody knows it. That is a very simple example of viral marketing, but it's word of mouth, word of experience, if you like. And the point about it, we touched on this briefly yesterday, actually, it can bite you in the backside big time. It's not all good. This is where leadership communication really starts earning its money. If you put into Google Dell Hell, you'll get over 2 million results. And that's a typical example of how all these online media now are attacking corporate brand, corporate reputation, therefore ultimately the corporate leadership. What happened here was very simple. One person, a fellow, a young man, bought some Dell equipment. A couple of weeks later, something had gone wrong. Battery ran out, probably. Is this Dell? No. And then he discovered, as I have personally, that when you start trying to contact their after-sales service, pretty difficult. He got a voice on the line, although it was a local telephone number, he was getting call. He was conversing with someone in Hyderabad. Has anyone had this experience? Dell? No? Lucky you, I have. The first thing they'll ask for, if you can get through, the first thing they'll ask for is your zip code or postcode, because they want to put you on their marketing database. I said, no, do that later. I got a problem now. My battery's not working and I need to get it fixed. Is there anyone there that can help me? He was so incensed, angered, by the lack of help that he got, that he, later that day, was writing on his blog about his experience, and he thought, well, I'm probably a lonely person in this, pointing out my experiences as a one-off example. Nope, he was wrong. Within 2 hours, there were thousands and thousands of very similar blogs attacking Dell for exactly the same kind of problem. And so that became Dell Hell. And once it's taken off, it's very difficult to claw it back, isn't it? I mean, it just spreads, you know, like a virus through the system. Michael Dell, by that time, had actually sort of retired from the business he had set up himself. But the share price went down the river. Mr. Dell himself came back into the business to try and sort things out and bring it back in. And they've learned some lessons. But not just Dell. Microsoft sucks. IBM sucks. HP sucks. You know, if you go on to a search engine, you find out they're all there. So these are the issues that the modern leader has to cope with. Are they worried? You know, would you worry if you saw a headline like this after a meeting that you'd run? All you need is that headline, and the rest, as they say, is history. So here's a few very interesting examples of really, really bad communication case studies. I won't go through all of them, but look at McDonald's. Look how much risk they're facing. They sell millions and millions of meals a day. They only have to have one that has got E. coli in it, or salmonella. Just one hamburger with salmonella in it, and they've got a problem. And I think, in respect, we have good and bad things to say about McDonald's, but let's be honest. The fact that we very rarely see anything of that kind about McDonald's, bearing in mind that they sell millions and millions of meals every single day across the world, says something about their quality control and their product processes, really. You might not think it's... What about Tiger Woods? Did he handle it well? Could he handle it well? That's the point, you know, sure. Not good leadership quality, that. You know, someone once said that Adolf Hitler, if he hadn't been running Germany, would have made a really, really good middle level of executive for Eastern Airlines. But I just wonder what Tiger Woods would... And, you know, the stupidity of people often... I'm sorry, Tiger, but we've got a case... I know there are British people in the room, and they will know with me, that we've got an instance at the moment of a scandal of similar nature to Tiger Woods involving a very senior and well-known English soccer player and his wife, or soon-to-be ex-wife, Cheryl Cole, who, you know, the increasingly famous singer. She's well-known in the UK. And what's happened is, of course, that she's discovered all his infidelities, and a lot of them were through text messages. That's strange. I mean, people should do that. Do you not think? Would you do that? Well, anyway, the lesson to learn here, from a communication point of view, is once it's gone, it's gone. You know, it's gone and it's there for posterity, and it's easily recoverable and so on, and Del Hell and all the rest of it. Is part of that picture. So, yeah. Yes, I mean, it changed all the rules for executive communication or communication of all kinds, in that it's now an open market. And there aren't any rules as there were before. No controls. Yeah, let's try and do that now. Yeah. Let's try and do that now. Let's go past the media and let's go through a little checklist. And that wasn't a prompt, I know, but because you didn't know what was coming up next. But yeah, you're looking at all this stuff, you know. 20 years ago it was difficult. Now it's all out there. You can't control it. It keeps coming back at you. You don't even know who's got what. Very easy to send stuff around and to make things visible. The first thing about communication is, and it's true now, I mean, the essential rules haven't changed. What's changed is the scale of it and this vast conversation and the fact that it's everywhere and you can't kind of keep it under control or manage it. But the first thing you're doing as a leadership communication is about building your trust bank, as we say. It's building that trust bank up. And that trust bank is what you draw down on when things go bad. Now, the funny thing about Tiger Woods is he sort of had a trust bank, but it was the wrong kind. You know, he deliberately portrayed himself as very solid professional, family man, very low-key, didn't get involved in things. And in fact, it was the complete opposite. He was a rabid gambler and womanizer. And so he didn't have a trust bank. You know, when Shell and the others, Johnson & Johnson, got hit by big scandals like product recalls or, in Shell's case, the Brent Spar platform, which created an enormous environmental debate and argument, and indeed almost civil war. I mean, the gas stations were being firebombed in Germany, and it got very serious. The fact is that they had a trust bank to draw down on. And people would intuitively and instinctively say, yep, they've got a problem here, but actually over the years they've been pretty good, haven't they? They did this, they did that, they've been very reliable and so on. That's the trust bank. And that's why you need to communicate. And Tiger Woods, to be honest, didn't have a trust bank because he didn't communicate. He never did. He never really gave any interviews. He never gave the simple things like he would turn away young kids who wanted an autograph. Simple things like that, they don't help. And that's a very crass example, I suppose. But leaders who do not communicate have not built a trust bank. And when things get difficult, they've got nothing to draw down on. And so that's very important, I think. That the media, all of them, the old as well as all the new online digital stuff and all the social networks and all the rest of it, from Facebook to Second Life or whatever you want to call it, there's so much of it now, are the enemy of reputation. And the important thing for you to know is that when you're in a situation where you communicate, whether it's a good situation or a bad situation, the first thing you say will always travel the furthest. That's the thing people remember. I'll give you a good example of Zeebrugge. It was the capsizing, the sinking of a cross-channel ferry between Holland, I presume, and the UK. And they found the boss who was out hunting that day when the ship was sinking. He was out hunting. They dragged him back. And the media were all waiting for him to give a statement. And he walked past and said, no, with his English hunting clothes and his funny hat. No, too much to do. Talk to you later. Very bad idea. You must engage immediately. The first things you do or say will travel the furthest. So the immediate priority really is get in there. And by that means you set the scene. You actually write the first chapter of the story. Stick to the facts. Not emotion. Avoid speculation. All of these are very, very important tips, I think. Prove you care. And when you give that statement, where you say, we are terribly saddened to hear of the accident with so and so and so on, do not read it from a written piece. It's got to come from the heart, not from the paper. Very important. And that's another important aspect of good communication, whether you're a leader or not. And build the conversation, get a two-way street. And that's what sensible companies are now doing with all this online new media, by the way, is they're joining in the conversation. They're joining in the conversation. They will have their own websites and networks where you are invited to come in and learn. By the way, it's a fantastic opportunity to tell them more about your products. Maybe new products that are coming down the line, or some wonderful stories about your product in use. So all those things. I mentioned earlier that one thing I learnt at the BBC is when you write your scripts, you use only 800 words. Shakespeare used 250,000, by the way, in the collected works of Shakespeare. 800 words. It's got to be get it first time language. It's got to be language, as we say, is sticky, sticks. You know why? Because when you speak, it's not the same as reading a newspaper. When you read a newspaper, you think, don't quite understand. Oh, of course, you look back and read it. Oh, yeah, of course, silly me. With a spoken word, it's once, it's gone. And we work on that hypothesis in that theory in broadcasting as well. It's got to go straight at them, and it's got to stick. So you might think, 800 words, that's not a lot. I reckon a normal person in a typical day doesn't use more than 200. Unless you're in a professional situation or something. But if all you're doing is going shopping, it's how much is that? How are you? How are the kids? Where are you going on holiday? It's not very complicated. I'm not saying we're all stupid. I'm just saying we don't use many words. And good communication is about the effective use of words. Does anyone disagree with that, though? Do you find 800 words...
Huh? 200 is low.
200? Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, we call in broadcasting, we call our audience Fred and Frieda Factory, Mr. and Mrs. Average. And we write for them. We don't write for a Nobel Prize winner. We write for them. Haven't met your mother-in-law. Sure. But this is so important, this simplicity thing. There's a Harley Davidson down there, look. People buy stories, you've got to tell stories. A book I can recommend, and it came up in our seminar yesterday, is The Dream Society by Rolf Jensen. I do recommend that. Written by a group from the Copenhagen Institute of Futures Research. They are a futurist think tank, but they came up, looked at this whole issue of what people are listening to when they're being communicated with, and they're listening for stories, actually. And the great marketing stories of recent years are about stories. People will pay a lot more, a price premium for a product if they actually like the story that's associated with it. So, for example, when you buy Ralph Lauren clothes, you're not simply buying clothes. Ralph Lauren's clothes come from the ethos of wealthy polo playing individuals, probably in the Hamptons if you live around the east coast of the United States. You're buying into a sort of a club that's designated by, as I say, polo playing wealthy people. You're not part of it, but you'd like to be part of the story. You can't afford to play polo, but you can afford to share the dream, and I think that's very much the case there. These are three examples of products that rely very closely on stories. The Harley Davidson, and we all know why people buy it. Tell us why you bought it. National Bicycle Company of Japan, they sell a story that they care. I'm going to whiz through and go to the final section because I think it's important to look at the psyche of an organisation and why you need to communicate that psyche. But the case study with National Bicycle Company of Japan is that they sell a lot of bikes in Japan, and you don't go to a bike store. You actually go to a kind of internet cafe, and you have on screen, and you can design your own bike. Harley Davidson do the same thing, I think. You can choose the colour and the size of wheels and how many gears you're going to have. Perfect bike. Oh, my dream bike. Send your payment details in. And it's made within 4 hours, because they have these huge assembly workshops in the middle of Japan in low-rent areas. And so by 3 o'clock that afternoon, your bicycle is actually ready, your dream bicycle, thing you've been thinking about for weeks and weeks and months. They then do something which is interesting. They hang on to the bicycle for 2 more weeks before they deliver it, because they have discovered by research that their customers enjoy the excitement of the wait. All right, so that's the story. Let's go through this. I want to come to the end. The whole notion of the corporation, and you can get these off the website, all of these slides, they are quite interesting. The whole notion of the corporation, and you're the leader of this corporation, and you're communicating on its behalf, is that you're out there to kill everyone, kill the opposition. And that's your legal requirement. Certainly in Anglo-Saxon law, you have to put the shareholders above absolutely everything else. Self-interest, and the customers come last. It's not right, but there you go. And as a result of that, what have we been selling for 50 years in the cigarette market? We've been selling ill health, and it's a dishonest industry for that reason. Maybe they'll get more honest. But the dishonesty epidemic was the thing that drove me to write Bullshit Factor, and I'm now rewriting it because we've had the whole banking scandal as well, which is another generation of the same problems. And here's the great map of corporate scandals. But I want to go through, and I've got the credit crunch and nothing ever, and trust us, we're experts, but you said we're experts, you know. You told us that we could trust you and it would all work. So really we've got a transparent future is what you've got, whether you like it or not. But the three new scarcities, we solved all the problems of economic scarcity. Now we've got this sort of moral scarcity, if you like, and the biggest problem of all, the scarcity of trust. And we've written books on it. This is Fukuyama's book. And we need now to have a completely new mental model of how to engage our communicators, our customers and our stakeholders, and that's for you as a communicator to grasp hold of that. And in doing that, trust and authenticity are absolutely central. Let's remind ourselves what the word authentic means, because I'm coming now in this final section, sorry for rushing a bit, so I realise we're up against time, is that the new concept of leadership is about authenticity. It's not about Jack Welch at General Electric killing the opposition and firing 10% of his management workforce every year and getting to those results, fantastic results. They're about being authentic, conforming to fact and worthy of trust, reliance or belief, absolutely. And that's the rise of the authentic leader. If you want a very interesting case study, check out Ricardo Semler and read his book if you want, The 7-Day Weekend. He gave his company, it's a Brazilian engineering company, he gave it to the employees. They in effect own it. They set their own salaries. They set their own wages. They set their own holidays. They approve or disapprove of new product and product innovation. They run the place. Think about it. Set their own salaries. Yeah, well, if they pay themselves too much, the company's going to go bust. If they give themselves too many vacations, the company will disappear. So there's a self-interest logic here. And really, when you look at a company, the company that you as a leader are representing, the company has psychological realities, just like a person. And this is very much the central theme of the book. As I say, those of you who were not here earlier, the book, my book, The Bullshit Factor, you can just go onto my website, jamesdelaney.com, and download the whole of the introductory section for free. Don't bother to buy it. And it'll give you all the key ideas, actually, that we're discussing here. A company has psychological verities, and like individuals, they can be dysfunctional. A dysfunctional individual is someone who has blocking emotions that can't allow progress, that get in the way, that block vision, block clarity. And if you're going to be a communicator, you've got to have that clarity and the simplicity and the clear view of where you're going and who you are and what you're doing. And so really a healthy psyche is made up of this new kind of leadership, this pattern of leadership that we're beginning to see emerging. Because we are at another tipping point, really, are we not? We're at a tipping point into new kinds of leaders. Because the old industrial and commercial leadership, they're actually, you know, moving on. They're retiring, and we're now bringing on a completely new generation of managers. Quick final point, then. We identified in the book 7 different emotions within any corporate psyche. 7. 6 of them, the bottom 6, are negative. 3 of them are negative passive. The bottom 3 are negative and they're negative passive. Timidity, pessimism. I don't know what to do. Oh my God, I can't be bothered. The middle 3, aggression, frustration and timidity, are negative aggressive, negative active. They are things you do. Levi Strauss said Calvin Klein jeans are no problem for us because we're better than them. We know the market. They were wrong. Calvin Klein took over a large segment of their market, Calvin Klein or Diesel or Gap or whatever, and Levi Strauss found themselves in huge difficulties. The only positive emotional state we identified was courage. Courage is when you have perceptual clarity. This is a sort of ladder of perceptual clarity. No bullshit. It's a bullshit-free zone right at the top, courage. And that is the primary foundation of good communication. If you do not have clarity, your communications will not be effective. because they won't achieve those things of simplicity and clarity that I mentioned earlier. So courage is the highest level of emotional state within any organisation. And so I'll leave you with this. As a communicator, as a leader, authenticity of leadership, and look at, as I say, look at Ricardo Semler as a case study. There are many others. We're also looking at clarity, keep the bullshit away, define your vision, make sure that the vision of your company matches that of your employees. We discover that in many, many companies, people hang up their own moral viewpoints with their jacket and coat in the morning when they start and become somebody else. And then when they go home in the evening, they put back on their cultural values and go home and be somebody else all over again. This is dichotomous, and this is almost schizophrenic. And it's a very, very bad model, really. Anyway, listen, time's getting on. I hope some of that was of interest. Do try and download my bit of my book, read it, and I wish you all the best of luck. And if you want to stay behind now and have a chat, fine. I've got to go and sit in something called Meet the Experts. Since I've just rubbished all the experts, I think I'm a bit worried about that. It will be, yeah. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it is. So if the organisers make it available, yeah, which I think they have. The means by which, I don't know, presumably the website. Yeah?